It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Today, food to die for. It might not seem like a great mealtime topic, but food and death really do go hand in hand. They're both an essential part of life, and what would a funeral be without food? Today, we're talking about the places where food and death come together. From Southern funeral cooking, to the new death dinner movement, to the traditional prisoner's last meal. So let's go first to Huntsville, Texas, where Brian Price spent more than a decade working as a chef on death row. His job was to prepare the last meals for inmates facing execution. Brian took that job seriously, and he wound up writing a memoir called Meals to Die For. It includes recipes written with a certain amount of gallows humor.
The first recipe that I came up with, I wrote a recipe called Old Sparky's Genuine Convict Chili, Old Sparky being the nickname of the electric chair. And I wanted it in 5,000, 10,000, and 20,000 volts of spiciness. And I was just going to, mild, medium, and hot. And I was just going to leave it like that and just try to market that, sell it to some food company and be some crazy, quirky thing. It would probably sell great. I was going to leave it right there. And then it came to me. I said, well, there's only one way to paint this whole thing. I said, the last meal is not a colorful thing that should be displayed in any other way than in pitch black, which it is, just like the crimes and the executions themselves. So I started coming up with the darkest names possible and try to have some little ring to them so folks take it as dark humor. I take it just painting everything jet black now. There's only one way to look at the last meals, just like everything else. It's a dark and morbid thing.
When you call things like, uh-oh, I'm dead meatloaf and obituary onion rings and broad axe brown gravy, so do you mean those to be funny or not?
No, not now. Not now. It's a lot of folks are going to think it's funny. When I first started, yes, it was dark humor, and I was going to stop it, like I said right there. No, I want people to look at it as just what it is, a very dark and morbid thing. And the recipes, whatever the title it has on them, is going to be a person's very last meal on this earth for some dark and horrible crime that they committed. And the victim's family is going to view this man's death. His family is going to view his death. The whole thing is just a very dark and sinister thing. It's like a tragic play where everyone becomes a victim in the end. And I just wanted to keep it just like that and keep it dark and sinister.
Tell me about the first death row meal you ever cooked.
The first meal I prepared was for a man named Lawrence Buxton. That particular day, no one wanted to prepare the last meal. The general policy of Texas Department of Corrections that they didn't force one of the cooks to prepare the last meal. They would ask for a volunteer. And this came from the dinner cooks, the supper cooks, is what we call supper down here in Texas.
Why didn't anybody want to cook this guy's last meal?
Well, that particular day, most guys didn't want to prepare it anyhow because it like gave them the creeps or something. They didn't want anything to do with it. Most of the cooks didn't. And when my sergeant asked if anybody else wanted to do it, I just kind of resigned to the fact, well, I guess I'll do it, Sarge. And so I prepared the meal, and I decided I was going to do my very best and did it with passion. And when I completed sent it over there, I prayed over it. And then the next day, I was calling him a captain's office, and he said, listen, Price, he said, that man that they killed last night, he said he wanted to thank you for that last meal. He said he really enjoyed it. Well, I wouldn't expect anything like that, Ann. Well, it just kind of threw me back a little bit. So that day I went back and I reflected upon that and thought about it. That might have been the last thanks that this man ever gave to anyone right before he left this earth. So I went back in the following day. I told my supervisor, I said, listen, if you want me to prepare the last meals from now on, I'll do it, so you don't have to just ask someone to do it anymore and volunteer. And they were all for that because it took a load off of them. So for the next 10 years, I prepared all the last meals from 1991 to 2001, almost 200 of them.
Wow. In the book, you kind of describe what happens sort of minute by minute, like in the kitchen, and in terms of how the whole last meal ritual goes. Can you run me through that?
It is a ritual. Everything is done by time. I usually start around 1 o'clock, start getting things together. By 2 o'clock, I'd do this. And I wanted everything to be fresh and hot and stay hot and be ready to go. We didn't have a hot box, so to speak, that they rolled over there. Like if it was some type of steak or cheeseburger or whatever, I'd start preparing the meat just right around 3 o'clock, and I'd be wrapping them up, and while they're still just right off the fire, the cheese melting on them and such, and have them wrapped up in saran wrap, then we'd cover the whole tray with butcher paper so it could be delivered without anyone seeing what that last meal is as they take it across the yard and through the bull ring into the death chamber. After that, then clean up, and then I'd always go back to my cell, and I'd start watching the clock because the execution time is usually right at 6 o'clock, and the news would always be covering something on it. And I'd start watching the clock. I had a little digital clock on top of the television. I'd watch those red numbers tick away. I'd say 6 o'clock, 6:01. I said, well, he's hooked up to the IV now, 6:03. I said, well, he's probably giving his last statement. 6:05, I said, well, I guess that old poison's starting to flow. He's probably getting put to sleep right now so that he won't feel the poison entering his veins. And then about 10, 15 after, he's gone. From my vantage point in my cell, I was up on the third tier. I could see the yard, which is an asphalt yard there, about 50 meters square, in the walls unit, which is surrounded by 20-foot red brick walls. I could see where the hearse, I'd watch when the hearse would come in, which would be about 10, 15 minutes before the execution was to take place, all the way to when they would bring the body back out. And the whole thing was a very sobering experience.
You said a bunch of the other guys who worked in the commissary didn't really want to cook for the last meals because it gave them the creeps. Why, do you think?
Just the association with the execution, death, and a lot of guys, when it inadvertently made them kind of look at their own mortality, and most of them didn't want to face that. And some of them, but for the grace of God, you know, they could have been right there on that death gurney themselves. A lot of my friends there in prison were murderers, and I believe it just made a lot of them face their own mortality, thinking, man, that could have been me, and they didn't want anything to do with it.
Hmm. Did it feel different to you, cooking somebody's last meal?
Oh, absolutely. I had to not necessarily psych myself up for it, but I prepared myself emotionally and spiritually for it. Each one that I prepared, they would give me the last meal request about 3 days ahead of time. And so I knew pretty much what I was going to have to do or what I wouldn't be able to do. And I would start thinking about it then and meditating on it, praying about it and such. And when the day come, I was pretty well ready for it. Now, some were a little bit harder than others, depending on who it was and how celebrated, so to speak, the case was. Like Carla Faye Tucker, for instance.
What did she ask for her last meal?
2 bananas, 4 peaches, a nectarine, a sliced cucumber, a garden salad and ranch dressing. My captain that day, Captain Faye Parkins, a very compassionate, godly woman, she came in and brought in some paper plates. Normally we serve the last meals on the officer's dining room, plastic dishes. They were green with a green tray. That particular day, Captain Parkins brought in some little flowered paper plates, very feminine looking. And she said, I want you to put on this, Brian. And then she didn't even leave. She stayed right there with me. She helped me peel the peaches. She sliced them. She arranged them very, very pretty on the plates. And we sliced the cucumber and peeled it. Had everything just looking very nice. Then we wrapped everything like we normally do in saran wrap. And when she was done, Captain Parkins looked down at that plate, and she kind of touched her hair back. Her hair was pulled back kind of short. And I could tell that she was fixing to have an emotional display. And she said, well, that's about the best we can do. And she turned around and walked away right quick, went to her office. Hmm. Well, we sent the plate over there, and Captain Parkins delivered it in person, which he never did. And I warned her about it. I said, Captain, I don't think you ought to go over there, and you know, I don't know if you're up for that. Well, she did, and she met her. And when she came back, I walked into her office, and I said, well, Captain, how was she? And she said, Brian, she was just the sweetest girl. She said she thanked us for the meal, and she said she was praying for us. And I looked at Captain Parkins and I said, well, she handled it pretty well. Like, is she willing to face her maker? And Captain Parkins looked at me and she just burst into tears and she waved me away right quick. And so I left the office and I came back about 10 minutes later when she called me and she apologized for losing it like that. She said, Brian, I shouldn't have went over there. You know, you were right. And Carla Faye Tucker ended up not even eating that meal. I don't know if that's ever been released either. She sent it back just the way we sent it over, still wrapped up. She elected to fast rather than have that last meal.
Was there ever anybody who did something so bad you just felt like you couldn't cook their last meal? You just couldn't do that?
There was only one that I asked to be excused from, and it was Leo Narvaez. He was from San Antonio, which is my hometown, and he murdered 4 children from the ages of 9 to 19. They were friends of my daughter's that she used to walk to school with, and Leo had been dating the 15-year-old girl, Shannon, and when she broke up with him, he couldn't handle it, and he kept harassing and harassing. The family moved away from the neighborhood, even where my daughter was at, and moved to a trailer park on the other side of town. Well, Narvaez, he found out where they was, got coked up one night and drunk, and went over there, and in a frenzy, killed them all with butcher knives. The youngest one was stabbed 63 times. One knife was broke off in him, and he grabbed another one and still kept getting him. I always tried to do my very best on every last meal, do it with conviction and with passion. And I felt like I could not do that with the same conviction and the same passion that I did with every other one. So I asked to be excused from that particular one. In the end, he didn't request the last meal, so it worked out regardless. But that was the only one that I asked to be excused from.
Hmm. You said before that before you cooked somebody's last meal, you thought about it a lot. You kind of meditated. Maybe you spent some time praying beforehand. What kind of things did you think about?
Well, being that I researched the crimes, I thought about the crimes they committed naturally. And then I'd also think about, well, why would they order this particular item? One man ordered butter beans, for instance. I can't particularly remember the particular name of that one. But I thought, butter beans. Why would he order butter beans for a last meal? And I started reflecting upon it, and I said, wow, it's probably something that his mom served for him when he was a kid, and it's going to take him back to that time where he could smell the butter beans, and you know how smells and sounds and sights will take you back to a particular time in your life, pleasant and unpleasant. But this particular one would take him back to a pleasant time and maybe give him a little bit of peace and comfort right before he left this world. And so things like that is what I would think about. And naturally, then I prayed for that particular person. You know, me being a Christian, I'd ask for the Lord to deliver them, and I'd hope that they find him before he goes to meet him. And I prayed for myself to be able to get away, and for all the officials, the warden on down the line, to be able to perform this grim task and do it as mercifully as possible, if there is any mercy in that.
The final meal request for Kevin Lee Zimmerman, the state of Texas, January 21st, 2004. One double meat cheeseburger with lettuce, tomatoes, onions, salad dressing, and ketchup. Half a plate of French fries, almost burnt, with ketchup. 4 half pints of milk. 1 piece of chocolate cake. Lots of icing.
Brian Price prepared the last meals for hundreds of death row prisoners, and he wrote about it in a memoir with recipes called Meals to Die For. In 2011, Texas abolished the tradition of special last meals after the man convicted of killing James Byrd Jr. ordered a 10-course meal and then said he wasn't hungry. When you hear that song, When the Saints Go Marching In, and you're in the South, you know it's time for a funeral. Southern funerals are unlike any others. They're meant to be enjoyed, but there are rules and rituals to observe, especially when it comes to the menu. Mississippian Charlotte Hayes says no self-respecting Southerner would dream of being buried without a spread of tomato aspic, coconut cake, maybe some Bing cherry salad with Coca-Cola. Hayes is co-author of Being Dead is No Excuse, the official Southern Lady's Guide to Hosting the Perfect Funeral. She spoke with Jim Fleming.
The one thing I want to say is funerals bring out the very best in people. Weddings bring out the very worst. You've got too much time to plan for a wedding. Not that you don't plan for your funeral. I mean, I'm constantly reviewing the music that I intend to use. I think very rarely does a Southerner get much past 35 without starting to plan this all-important event. You know, you want to get it right. We had a friend's mother who, the funeral's described in this book, who left behind directions to be laid out on the formal dining room table. And in her funeral direction, she kept describing herself as poor dead me. The other thing you got to know about the funeral is if you're looking at ladies' tombstones, don't pay any attention to the date. We lie about our age in life and in death. A Southern lady, you know, the idea of an open coffin visitation makes her want to look real nice.
Now, you said, as a matter of fact, some of the people you've seen in the open coffin visitations looked better than you ever remembered them seeing.
Oh, absolutely. In Greenville, we always say that Billy Boone, actually we call him in the book Bubba Boone because we don't want anybody to know who he is. He's the undertaker, or he was until he himself passed into glory. But anyway, we always said that he could make you look better than any plastic surgeon in the country. But there was a hitch. You had to be dead.
Now, in the Delta, you're either a Methodist or an Episcopalian. You say the Episcopalians have better funerals, but the Methodists make better food, right?
Oh, well, yes. The Methodists cooking is the mother lode of funeral cooking. One of the things we found that we had not expected was that the Methodist ladies and the Episcopal ladies are very competitive about their dishes. Now, funeral food is Campbell's cream of mushroom soup and Velveeta base. It's basically a Methodist cuisine with an overlay of Episcopal dishes such as tomato aspic with homemade mayonnaise. We almost call this book Being Dead is No Excuse for Store-Bought Mayonnaise. It's the Methodist cooking, the casseroles, that's the dominant food for funerals. In fact, the founder of Greenville was a Methodist lady. Got to tell you, all her descendants are Episcopalians, but she was a Methodist lady named Mrs. Thibble, Harriet Blanton Thibble, and she was the mother of Greenville because she gave land to rebuild the town after hostilities I will not mention. But Gayden and I, my co-author, decided that she should not only be known as the mother of Greenville, she should be known as the mother of the covered dish casserole, because that's what Methodists bring to funerals. If you see a lot of covered dish casseroles, you know a Methodist has died, and in fact, one of the recipes in the book, one of the favorites, is the Methodist lady's chicken lasagna Florentine.
Oh.
It's really good, and it may kill you. I wanted to sort of tell people what's the real difference between a Southern Episcopalian and a Southern Methodist. So could I read about a paragraph on that?
Oh, sure. Go ahead.
Okay. Southern Episcopalians wear their devoutness lightly. That is one reason they excel at funerals. They have a knack of comfortably mixing the formal and the casual, the proper and relaxed, or perhaps the proper and the highly improper. Nowhere has this sensibility been better summed up than in the immortal words of Anne Dudley Hunt. Of course, she was Anne Dudley something else at the time. One Easter even, that's Episcopalian for the day before Easter, Anne Dudley was hobbling around the kitchen, bravely dyeing Easter eggs, despite her knees, which were bruised black and blue. "I just don't know," Anne Dudley said. "Did I hurt my knees yesterday afternoon doing the Stations of the Cross, or did I do it last night falling down drunk?" That, in a nutshell, is Southern Episcopalianism. Now, to her credit, Anne Dudley remains a loyal daughter of St. James, even though the bishop put his foot down and flatly refused to let her have her fourth wedding there. The fifth time, she was too proud to ask. And that's the Southern Episcopalian.
I can hardly wait to get to the Methodist now.
Well, now they, since they're in the Delta, they're sort of part Methodist and part Delta, which means they do like to have a drink. But it wouldn't be permissible, for example, for somebody to pass out on Christmas Eve drunk at the Methodist Church, we do believe. And that happens in Greenville, at the Episcopal Church.
Yeah. Now, are there some considerations that you have to take into account? I mean, there must be some foods that would not quite be proper for a funeral reception.
Absolutely, absolutely. You would never bring marinated ripe olives to a funeral reception. It's too much like a cocktail party. Ditto hot feta cheese artichoke dip, not for funerals. Let me tell you, the main thing about funeral food is it's supposed to bring you comfort. It's not supposed to be sophisticated like marinated olives or big shrimp. These are sophisticated dishes you might want on some really festive, in a different way, occasion. You want a lot of carbs, you want a lot of Velveeta, you want a lot of breadcrumbs, you want a lot of sour cream blending in it. You want things that are comfortable. And there are a lot of food snobs around, and, you know, they want hummingbird tongue on toast. But even those people at a funeral give in, and they love the goo.
Yeah.
They love the comfort.
I think we all like the goo and the comfort if we're honest about it.
Well, we always say that for whom the bell tolls, when somebody dies in Greenville, it tolls for me, and it says open a can of cream of mushroom soup and start cooking.
And then there is the really important question. It's so important you hardly want to deal with it, and that's the question of whether they're stuffed eggs or deviled eggs.
Yes, we say stuffed eggs, and Yankees say deviled eggs, and there's sort of a sub-feud over that as to whether you want savory or sweet. I happen to prefer savory. I hope I haven't alienated anyone. But we give recipes for both kinds. And the other thing you have to have at a funeral is the South's version of pâté. This is pimento cheese. There's just nothing like a silver plate stacked high with pimento cheese sandwiches. You absolutely have to make them very delicate with the crust cut off, or people will talk bad about you.
Charlotte Hayes is co-author of Being Dead is No Excuse, the official Southern Lady's Guide to Hosting the Perfect Funeral. She spoke with Jim Fleming. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
The modern supermarket has lately been taken over with all sorts of things that look like food, might even taste like food, but are really just edible food-like substances.
That's journalist and food activist Michael Pollan.
You know, if you look at something like bread now, I mean, you can make bread with flour and water, a pinch of salt, a little bit of water. Now there are breads in the supermarket with 40 or 50 ingredients. Why is that? Well, they want it to last for a really long time. And to do that, you have to use the latest techniques of food science. And you also have to remove most of the nutrients from the food. Because the way you make something durable when it comes to food is to make it unappealing to microbes and bacteria and fungus. And, you know, I have a Twinkie on my shelf that I've had for 2 years.
In fact, one of your guidelines is if it doesn't rot, then you shouldn't eat it.
Yeah. This is a good rule of thumb because what is rotting? I mean, rotting is, you know, other creatures deciding that, ooh, this is tasty. I'm going to have some of this too. And the reason none of these organisms want my Twinkie is because it's not very nutritious. And that's been true, you know, since we first learned how to make white flour. I mean, the reason white flour lasts on the shelves for years is because the bacteria have no interest in it, and the rats have no interest in it. And we should pay attention to them. You know, they know something about nutrition.
In other words, not only is a lot of the food we eat technically dead, it's also killing us. Michael Pollan isn't the only one to make that point. Luckily, there's an antidote, the farmer's market.
Carol Knapp, Knapp's Fresh Veggies from West Bend. We specialize in tomatoes and winter squash and Brussels sprouts and stuff like that. We do a lot of heirlooms. We have well over 100 heirlooms, things you can't buy the seeds in the store. I joined a group last winter called Tomatoville, and they're big into the seed saving. I traded for over 100 new varieties, or varieties new to me this year. This is Cherry Roma, which is a grape variety, but dates back to the 1800s. This not-so-appetizing-looking strange green one is called Green Doctors. It's what's called a green one ripe, and it's very tasty, more so than you'd think. I think this one's the Mini Carol Yellow. It's a variety that was actually has been discontinued, and I've been saving the seeds for years. Okay, that's our Sun Sugar. Everybody loves the Sun Sugar Sun Golds, and they have just been so slow to ripen this year. We had 3 pints this week. That's it. You know, they're just not doing much for me anyway. It's been difficult to grow much of anything this year other than weeds.
I'm Dale Marsden. This is Marsden's Pure Honey. I have wildflower, buckwheat, and purple loosestrife honey today. That's what I have this time of the year. Early in the spring, I have dandelion and locust honey and sometimes Russian olive. I just got the buckwheat honey, and that's kind of it's like the taste of raisins in raisin bread. It's kind of that nice caramely flavor of raisins, cooked raisins. And then the purple loosestrife is from northern Wisconsin. It's an invasive, but they make good honey. It's sort of a real fruity, tangy flavor. It's from the flower. Every flower has sort of a different flavor. And some honeys, the pollen adds to that. If there's a lot of pollen in the honey. I run about 50 hives of bees a year.
Sounds from the Dane County Farmers Market, the largest in the country, right here in Madison, Wisconsin, to get us in the mood for another growing season. We've been talking in this hour about the connections between food and death. And it's funny, the point of eating is to sustain life. But maybe there's always a subliminal awareness lurking somewhere in the back of our minds that what we eat could also kill us. Sam Thayer is a wild forager. He teaches classes on wild harvesting, and he says in his work, the first thing he has to deal with is that fear.
About 10 years ago, a very agitated man approached me after a presentation I'd given on edible wild plants, and he launched into this frantic diatribe. You need to warn people that there's some edible plants that look exactly like deadly poisonous plants, and they grow side by side, and nobody can tell them apart. Nobody, not even an expert. Books tell people they can eat these plants, but they don't tell them that there's deadly poisonous plants that look exactly the same. It's like playing Russian roulette with your food. Of course, this isn't true. But the fear of wild plants runs very deep in our culture. If you want to see this fear in action, just mention to a coworker or a friend that you're going to go gather some wild vegetables over the weekend. they will almost certainly make a comment about death, dying, poisoning, or hospitalization. To a forager like me, the predictability of this is quite amusing. When you mention more statistically dangerous activities, such as bicycling or horseback riding or eating at restaurants, you'll get no such reaction. While it's certainly true that people can poison themselves with wild vegetation, the fear that we attribute to eating wild plants is monstrously out of proportion with the actual danger they pose. Poisonous plants aren't lurking in the woods, waiting to jump into our mouths and slither down our throats at the slightest faux pas. The consumption of an object is a deliberate act over which we have total control. You just need to follow one simple rule. Only eat something when you're absolutely certain of its identity and absolutely certain of its edibility. You learn what a plant is before you eat it. You don't guess, you don't hope, you know. It's really that simple. Wild food is all around us. Simply being reasonable and responsible makes foraging about the safest food-related activity that you could possibly engage in. In fact, over the last 40 years, I only know of one documented case in the United States of death by poisoning from a misidentified plant. So why are we so spellbound, fearful, even beguiled by the story of someone mistaking a poisonous plant for an edible one and then dying from the error? These poisonings almost never actually happen, yet we tell ourselves the story again and again. Every culture builds its own propaganda to promote stability. An important aspect of this propaganda is fables, stories made up to teach particular lessons. The poisonous plant fable involves a suite of admonitions that we find economically and socially useful. Don't stray too far from the beaten path. What civilization has given you is better than you realize. Nature can't be trusted. So be normal and live a predictable life of routine. These messages are compelling when a torturous death is presented as the cost of disregarding them. But unfortunately, this belief robs us of perhaps our best chance to be intimate with nature, through our mouths. And it's only through these intimate connections that we learn to care.
Sam Thayer is considered one of the foremost experts in the U.S. on wild foraging. We've been sharing conversations at the intersection of food and death in this hour. And in Seattle, former restaurant owner Michael Hebb is combining them in a movement called Let's Have Dinner and Talk About Death. I like death cafes. Death dinners have clearly struck a chord. For example, just last year, on August 24th, coordinated death dinners took place in more than 300 cities all over the world. Michael Hebb believes there's nothing like a dinner table for sparking life and even world-changing conversations.
I've been focused on bringing people together around the table to discuss critical issues for almost 20 years. And it occurred to me that it would be remarkable to create an internet platform that not only just got the people that I could gather at a table, but inspired, you know, thousands and potentially tens and hundreds of thousands of people to have their own dinner parties around important topics. And so that's what we were on the search for, an issue that could really bring people together.
And then was there any particular inspiration that led you to think about combining dinner parties and death?
Yeah, I mean, of course in America we think that the dinner table should be for polite conversation, or we're told that. In practice, I think that's not necessarily the case. I've seen the table hold many remarkable and difficult and challenging conversations quite well. People tend to be relaxed and at their best at a table, very, you know, in a civil setting. When we were looking for what topic could really bring together a large percentage of the population, I happened to be on a train ride in between Portland and Seattle in the Northwest, and I started a conversation with two physicians that I didn't know. We were all strangers, and they threw a couple statistics about our healthcare system at me that stopped me in my tracks. And the first one was that 70% of Americans want to die at home, and only 25% of us do.
Oh, that's sobering.
Yeah, it's half of America, and that just stopped me right there. And then the other statistic that, you know, fit on top of that and made it very clear the direction we needed to take was that end-of-life expense is the number one cause of personal bankruptcy, and obviously the most expensive part of our healthcare system that in itself is having such difficulty. So the fact that half of America is not getting what it wants and paying dearly for it personally and institutionally made it really clear that we need to have this discussion.
So you had this idea of, well, what if I organized a series of dinners where people come together and simply talk about death? Let's go kind of a little deeper into the experience. What's it like to, tell me about the first dinner over death you held.
Well, the first one was actually at a healthcare conference or a group that was at a healthcare conference, Health 2.0 in San Francisco. And we didn't start small. It was some of the most important leaders in healthcare and people that really you would think might be a bit guarded at the table because they have a lot on the line and they're with other peers, you know, people that run major insurance companies and people that, you know, are writers in the space, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And what we immediately found is these very simple questions of asking people how they imagine their final days and who they'd want around them and what they would like that experience to be like, cracked right through any of that self-importance or that guardedness, even with that group. And there was laughter, there was tears, and then there was a deep engagement and camaraderie. So even at that level, it made me very clear that dear friends and family members and pretty much anybody can have this conversation to great effect.
Well, that's really interesting because you started out talking about, you know, a couple of statistics and about issues of money and healthcare decisions, but it sounds like the kind of conversation that you wanted to facilitate is something much, much more intimate.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is such a big issue. We're not forwarding any kind of, you know, agenda with this. It's really an open invitation for people to consider end of life in the way that they want to consider it with the people that they want to have the conversation with. You could be having it for philosophical reasons. You could be having it because you think you'd see those statistics and you want to plan for your own family or for yourself. You could be having it for spiritual reasons or because it just interests you. I think we wanted more than anything is to create the invitation and then to give people enough of enough structure that they felt safe and kind of held in the ability to have this experience powerfully.
Mm. So tell me how this works, because by now you've created a website with a kind of template so that people can decide to hold their own death dinners, and people have started doing that all over the country. So how do you word the invitation?
Yeah, it's tricky. So that's where you mentioned in the beginning that we have some really remarkable advisors and people involved in the project. And that was one of the first things I did was to talk to the smartest people in the space, you know, all the way from artists to doctors to people that have long history in holding this conversation and really just testing these questions and the type of conversations with them so that we could advise people how to have this conversation and give them suggestions. And the way that the website works right now, and I would like to say this, this is the beginning of the project. We have a large feedback loop with people that are using Let's Have Dinner and Talk About Death, and we hope to keep improving it. But it asks you who's coming to the table and how you best define yourself. Are you terminally ill, or is someone close to you terminally ill? Did someone that you care deeply about just pass, or are you just interested and curious? So as you make those selections on the website, it dynamically generates conversational prompts and actually homework for you so that people can have a shared experience before
homework.
They
what?
Break bread.
What kind of homework?
So for each dinner, people are asked to select a short piece to read, watch, and listen based upon their intention and who's coming to the table, and then to share that with their guests. So it can be, you know, a New Yorker article or a TED Talk or an NPR piece or a poem. There's a library that has been generated by our group that I think really is beautiful and provocative and thoughtful pieces on end of life, so that when you to, you know, crack that first bottle of wine or sit down and look at each other across the table and be like, okay, we're going to start this conversation, you actually have a shared experience. You've all read or watched and listened to something together.
Hmm. Do you, have you come up with any particular, I don't know, any kind of rituals, something to kind of, I'm thinking this could be a conversation that would feel a bit sacred. You might want to set it apart a bit from an ordinary, everyday, mundane conversation.
Yeah. We make some suggestions about taking it seriously and, you know, providing a home-cooked meal and lighting some candles and making it a special occasion. But I don't want the barrier of entry to be such that people are intimidated. I'm happy if people are having this conversation, you know, as part of a picnic or in a restaurant, wherever it is they happen to have dinner. But the as far as, you know, one element that we've made part of every dinner is the first conversational prompt, and that's to bring to the table somebody who has passed, an ancestor or somebody recently, who's meant a lot to you and why you admire them, so that the room is immediately filled with admiration and gratitude and respect for our ancestors. And I think that that creates a powerful envelope for the conversation.
Hmm. Michael, what do people wind up talking about? I mean, tell me about, I don't know, what are some conversations that have just really stayed with you from your experiences of death over dinner?
Gosh, I mean, I think it goes all over the map, which is, you know, great. There's levity, there's gravity, there's all kinds of the anecdotes. One of the anecdotes that I found so, you know, interesting and memorable was one of our students, because we taught this as part of a course at University of Washington, and the students actually designed the platform with us. And one of the students remembered that their grandfather had proposed to their grandmother over the dinner table, and how each night for 40 nights he had brought a single pearl and rolled it across the table to her, kind of with a mischievous smile at the end of 40 nights, and she had a full necklace, he then proposed marriage. And so those are priceless stories that I otherwise wouldn't have connected to around this student. So I think you're going to get a wealth of humanity, and you're going to get to know the people, you know, even your spouse or your children or your parents, you're going to get to know them better through this experience.
Michael Hebb is the founder of Let's Have Dinner and Talk About Death. If you want to hold your own death dinner, you'll find links for sample invitations, reading lists, and conversational prompts on our website. That's at ttbook.org. And that wraps up our discussion about food to die for. But don't go away. Coming up, we'll celebrate National Poetry Month with poets Billy Collins and Nikki Giovanni. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. And now, bookmarks, writers on books they love.
This is Billy Collins, and a book that I would like to talk about is a book called The Strange Last Voyage of Donald Crowhurst. It's a nonfiction book which concerns a nonstop, single-handed, round-the-world sailing race, and it took place in 1968. One of the participants was a man named Donald Crowhurst. He got a late start, and as he sailed off, he began, for some reason or other, I think he'd fallen behind, he began to send in false positions. He began to lie, like keeping two books, one on his head and then the false one, making himself way ahead of the pack. Francis Chichester actually was the first one to kind of smell a rat here, and he pointed out that these positions that were being radioed back by Donald Crowhurst were essentially impossible. They found Crowhurst's boat, this 40-foot trimaran, ghosting somewhere off the coast of South America. They found there this incredible log, but also a journal of about 25,000 words, which recorded clearly that Crowhurst was going mad. The writing becomes more and more surrealistic. Toward the end, it's sort of a Blakean visionary rant of some kind. It was clear that he committed suicide and was not sort of swept over by a storm, because down below, they found, among other things, a coffee cup with a spoon resting on top of the cup. And now, whether Crowhurst planted that there as an indicator that he was not swept overboard by turbulent weather or high seas, or whether that was just an accidental fact, we don't know. But it's a very compelling story. The book is written by two people, Nicholas Tomalin and Ron Hall. It's just an amazing story of how the desire to deceive others led to a kind of self-deception, which led then to a kind of madness and to insanity. I just like this whole strangeness of being isolated and being cut off. It's really the tangled web we weave when we practice to deceive, and Crowhurst gets completely tangled up in his web and kind of becomes his own spider.
Former U.S. Poet Laureate Billy Collins recommends The Strange Last Voyage of Donald Crowhurst by Nicholas Tomalin and Ron Hall. You'll find more bookmarks on our website at ttbook.org. And now it's time for On Our Minds. This week, poetry. April is National Poetry Month, and we're celebrating with some of our favorite interviews. Today we're going to hear from Nikki Giovanni. She's one of the most widely read American poets. She's published more than 30 books and helped carry the legacy of the civil rights and black power movements into the present. She's been called both a national treasure and a living legend. When Nikki Giovanni sat down to talk with Steve Paulson, she started with a poem called For Sandra.
I wanted to write a poem that rhymes, but revolution doesn't lend itself to bebopping. Then my neighbor who thinks I hate asked, "Do you ever write tree poems? I like trees." So I thought, I'll write a beautiful green tree poem. Peek from my window to check the image. Notice the schoolyard was covered with asphalt, no green. No trees grow in Manhattan. Then, well, I thought, the sky. I'll do a big blue sky poem. But all the clouds have winged low since No Dick was elected. So I thought again, and it occurred to me, maybe I shouldn't write at all, but clean my gun and check my kerosene supply. Maybe these are not poetic times at all. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 1967.
Yeah, I was going to say it has a very 60s sensibility to it. When you look back on a poem like that from a different part of your life, does that seem like a different you, or do you share those sentiments?
Oh, I love the 60s. I think we were a great generation. And actually, my next-door neighbor, Sandra, was dating Clifton Davis, the actor, and she lived with, shared an apartment next door with Morgan and Jeannie Freeman. Hmm. Actually, that was a great neighborhood, because directly across the street was Milford Graves and Don Pullum, musicians. Gregory Hines lived around the corner. George Faison lived around the corner. Sidney Poitier was a good friend of a guy named McHale's, and he would come over to McHale's, who ran a bar at 96 and Columbus. But it was quite a fun neighborhood, you know, and there's a lot of people around. But Sandra was her name, but we called her Cookie. And she was one of those people that was always curious, like, why are you people always being so mean? And, you know, and it's like, well, let me write this poem for her.
Well, it's interesting to hear you talk about all these artists from very different fields, but this is such a political poem too. And I'm wondering if were all those people in the neighborhood that you used to hang out with, did you kind of share a political vision with them?
I don't recall having that much discussion. I would never think of Morgan Freeman as political, but at that particular time, Morgan was doing Demilitarized Zone, and he was working in the village. He would, you know, take the train down with Novella Nelson, the actress, and they were all doing poetry, anti-war poetry in the DMZ. I think artists do what they think they need to do. The poets are probably always going to be the people in front because all we have is the words. You're going to do what your art lets you do, and you're going to do it in the way that you still have a lot of respect for yourself.
Well, throughout your career, it seems that you have really examined the role of poetry in politics. And I'm wondering how that's changed for you over time. What do you see as poetry's role in American politics?
Well, I think that I quit thinking about America so long ago. That's not a question I could really respond to like that because we have a global situation. There's just nothing that's happening now that's not global. All around the world, you know, the poets who are speaking up are being arrested. But I think that our job is to be as honest as we can about what we understand.
So if the job of the poet is to tell the truth, can the poet change people's minds? Change people's political view?
Oh, I doubt that. I don't think anybody, no. I think any poet that thinks that, and we've had a few that do, you know, they're crazy. I mean, that's not going to happen. But what you are doing is you're preaching to the choir. And so you're reminding people that the job that we're all doing is an honorable job, that the people have a right to be heard. But I think that what we do is we keep putting it out, and about 10 years later, somebody quotes us.
So just to pursue that then, so I'm just trying to figure out, so what you see as the role of the poet in society as, is it helping to shape a sensibility? Is helping people to reflect on what the times are all about?
I think of my job as my job, and that is I write. And I write as truthfully and as honestly. You know, so you asked my poem for Sandra. I enjoyed poem for Sandra. Would I write it today? I'm 68 years old. It'd be stupid.
Yeah.
You say, well, whoa, sure. What has she been smoking?
Well, can I take you back back into your own literary history a bit and ask you to read another poem from your 1970 collection, No Reservations?
Oh, that.
Page 68.
Thank you. There are no reservations for the revolution. No polite little clerk to send notice to your room saying you are wanted on the battlefield. There are no banners to wave you forward, no blaring trumpets, not even a blues note, moaning, wailing, lone blue note, to the Yoruba drum saying, strike now, shoot, strike now, fire, strike now, run. There will be no grand parade and a lot thrown round your neck. People won't look up and say, why, he used to live next to me. Isn't that nice? It's his term now. There will be no recruitment station where you can give the most convenient hours. Monday, Wednesday, I play ball. Friday night, I play cards. Any other time, I'm free. There will be no reserve of energy, no slacking off till the next time. Let's see. I can come back next week. Better not wear myself out this time. There will be reservations only if we fail.
Hmm. You know, I have to say it's wonderful to hear you read your poems. And I'm wondering have you always thought of your poems as something to be read out loud?
No, I'm a book person, and it's why I'm not a rapper. I'm always saying to my students, and we read aloud, and I'm always saying to them, you know, you have to read them aloud. If you can't read them aloud, they're not working because the eye can't do what the mouth can't do. You have to breathe. You know, so if you're doing Finnegan's Wake, you know exactly what Joyce was doing because he had to breathe, as do you. Hmm. I think that my poetry is very readable, and I would encourage anybody that was reading poetry to read aloud.
Well, I want to ask you to read another poem in there, and I think it's for Lena Horne, Poem for a Lady Whose Voice I Like.
Oh, yeah, it was for Lena, and she's my friend. People used to be on her because she's one drop-dead gorgeous. Lena's just a beautiful woman, and they told her she wasn't a good singer because she wasn't Ethel Waters and she wasn't even Josephine Baker. You know, she was a pop singer, really. And Lenny Hayden took over her musical career as well as, of course, they ultimately married at a time when black and white people were not allowed to be married. But people are cruel and you have to kind of protect yourself.
Hmm.
And you do that just by deflecting it. So he said, you ain't got no talent. If you didn't have a face, you wouldn't be nobody. And she said, God created heaven and earth and all that's black within them. So he said, you ain't really no hot stuff. They tell me plenty, sister, take care of better business than you. And she said, on the third day, he made chitterlings and all good things to eat and said, that's good. So he said, if the white folks hadn't been under your skirt and been giving you the big play, you'd have had to come on uptown like everybody else. And she replied, then he took a big, black, greasy rib from Adam and said, we will call this woman, and her name will be Sapphire, and she will divide into four parts that Simone may sing a song. And he said, you're pretty full of yourself, ain't you? So she replied, show me someone not full of herself, and I'll show you an empty person.
Oh, that is such a wonderful poem.
I love it. You know, she's just like, I'm having none of it. Don't hand me this.
Now, I have a question about how you write your poems, because I've heard that you don't really like to rework lines.
You can't really tweak it. And there's something in critics that make them think, oh, if you just change that word, you would have a better poem. Well, actually, no, baby, you wouldn't. You would have a poem that would be just a little bit lopsided. And I was laughing. I said, it's kind of like, you know, you're making, say, for example, a stew, and you know something's missing, so you put a little salt in. And then you put the little salt in, something's missing, so, oh, maybe I should do a little garlic, and you put a little garlic. And pretty soon, you've ruined it. Because what you should have done was
just thrown the whole thing out.
Well, just think about it. I mean, what I like to do, and I say that to my students at Virginia Tech too, just put it away. Relax. Go walk your dog. Go have a beer. Go have a glass of wine. Sleep on it. Try to think of what it is you're trying to do. Because you're not trying to write a poem. You're trying to tell a story. So you can't correct the poem. You have to make sure that the flow of the story is what you want it to be. And most writers really do. It's a weakness of the genre, I suppose. We all think our words are sacred. Langston Hughes said every writer needs a built-in, he said, SH detector. But I won't say that. It's probably a family show. But I think that Langston was right. Sometimes you've done the best that you can do. And sometimes that's good enough. Just give yourself a chance to be satisfied with your work. That's all you can ask of yourself.
Nikki Giovanni is the author of more than 30 books, and she is one of the most widely read and admired American poets. Steve Paulson talked with her. And that's it for today. This hour of To the Best of Our Knowledge was produced at Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison, Wisconsin. Thanks to Charles Monroe Kane, who produced this hour, and to Doug Gordon, Sarah Nix, Raman Tungakar, and Stephanie Youngblood. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.